All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum
freedom. Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome again to the Read Rothbard podcast. We're back in our normal locations this time, so we're using the old copper wire technology. How are you doing, Robert, now that you're back in the cabin?
I'm far away again. It's true. Through the magic of government benevolence, we can talk again. And I'm doing great. It's colder out here now. Yesterday I arrived when it was 80. Now it's 50. I don't know what's happening. But I got on a chair. I'm feeling good about life. I'm writing some good stuff. And I'm on the Read Rothbard podcast, and we're going to be talking about something. So I'm excited.
Yeah, that's good. That's good stuff. I'm glad you're back. It seems like you were gone for quite a while, and thank you for spending the time that you did with us here. We did enjoy having you, and also doing the live show where we watched Blazing Saddles and then did a little talk on that.
Yeah, and I guess most of it survived. Your microphone?
Yeah. So the microphone that we have tends to crap out after a certain amount of time, like 40 minutes to an hour, something like that. And usually Robert's able to tell me when we're on these calls, and so I unplug the mic and plug it back in, and then we edit that portion out so it seems rather seamless to you. But when we were doing it live, we just had the one microphone, and since there was nobody monitoring it, like we couldn't hear what it was being recorded, it just crapped out after, I think, 37 minutes of recording. I think that was the number. And granted, we'd had it plugged in for a while prior to that, so I don't know the exact time like that triggered this. But in re-listening to the audio, it seemed to self-correct after about 17 minutes because everything came back into focus. So I only lost about 17 minutes, and then through some audio wizardry, I was able to clean up about a two-minute snippet of it to retain the continuity of the episode. And so anyway, that's enough about my microphone. That's the microphone story. Yep, that's a good one. Good share. So a little bit of housekeeping before we start talking about the movie In Time, because I think that's what we had suggested in the previous episode that we would talk about on this episode. So we've got the email addresses that's now listed below the previous episode. I've been posting a few things to the Facebook. We've got the t-shirts and hoodies and stuff that's available. We're relooking at, the transcript type stuff. I'm starting to glean a lot of good stuff out of there, so we're going to be posting some of that as unique content. There was a supporting document that I put together for the Jeremy Bentham Matrix episode about the Panopticon. And so there's just a lot of good stuff like that going on. We could really use an army of volunteers to work on this stuff. Before the show, Robert and I were talking about some of the possibilities of things that we could do, and it really sounded like there was just so much work and so much content to go through that it would take a tremendous effort to get it out there. And we don't even know if there's a market for it, which is beautiful.
Yeah, it would all be – it's all a huge gamble. I mean, we're talking about turning the works of Murray Rothbard into a modern teaching lesson-type presentation with, like, a 3D animated Murray and having, in like, an animated lesson where he goes over whatever he happens to be talking about. But the audio quality of his old recordings, all done back in like the 70s and 80s, just isn't really good, isn't up to modern standards of presentation. So I was suggesting that they be reread by like an actor and lip-synced with the 3D character. And it would just be a tremendous amount of effort. Doable, but you're talking about creating all this content for a niche of a niche. I mean, we're talking about economics and an anarchist. And, I mean, anarchism is maybe 1%, maybe, of the population of the planet. And economics isn't even a core class that you take in school. It's not like math, science, or language. It's like an elective that you might take. You can, of course, get a degree in it, but it's mostly a secondary type education thing. And even then, just a small percentage of university goers take it. I don't think, is there Econ 101, is that like a requirement maybe in some liberal arts degrees? I don't even know. But, very super speculative to do all that.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I think that the business cycle does play a role in when these things are of interest to people. So like when unemployment is high and the economy goes into the shitter, people start looking for this kind of stuff. I think that's one of the things that motivated me to start looking into questions of the economy itself way back in the day. So perhaps, you know, we can just be in a position to have the resource available for when it does become more important or more useful.
Well, people would start looking at economics, sure, but there's still, Austrian school is, I don't even know if it's the most popular school.
Oh, no, hardly at all.
School, which is promoted by the governments of the world, and that was probably, I don't know what the statistics are, but I'm guessing that that's far more popular. I mean, you got people like Krugman and New York Times and other type of people that propagate all kinds of this Keynesian crap all over the news. You don't see a lot of Austrian perspective in the news. So you got the Mises Institute and maybe the Chicago School, maybe. Where what else do you have?
Well, the Chicago School is not great either. They're basically tinkerers of the state machinery to make it run more efficiently, and that's hardly a noble pursuit.
Yeah, so in the massive minority, even in this tiny little niche of the world of economics, I don't know. Tough road to hoe.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, before too much longer, we got to get into the episode here, but I do want to bring up a Murray quote that might sum up some of this, because economics is really everything. Right. If you really think about it, economics is people making decisions using their available resources to achieve their ends. So really, economics applies. Yeah, it's human action, and it applies to everybody. Even if they don't want to think about it or study it or learn it, and even if they did study and learn it, they'd learn about, you know, these complicated formula and models that are always wrong in the Keynesian or other mainstream economics kind of way. So like, even if you went to university and got a degree in it, you'd be learning the wrong stuff anyway. But there's a Murray quote that I can play here, or not play here, but just I'll read it. It's, quote, "It is no crime to be ignorant of economics, but it is totally irresponsible to have a loud and vociferous opinion on economic subjects while remaining in this state of ignorance."
Are you applying that to a guy like Paul Krugman?
I'm applying that to anyone who has any policy opinion that affects people. You know, anyone who wants to use the force of the state to mold behavior at the point of a gun and not understanding what the effects would be, they are
right.
Totally irresponsible and violent thugs.
True that, homie.
So let's round this back to this movie we wanted to talk about, In Time. It's a 2011 film, which surprised me a little bit because I felt like it was an older film than that, but it's not. It's only 5 years old. And it has the former teen heartthrob Justin Timberlake in as the main character. And do you remember much else from the story, or do you have a little brief overview? You're usually good at that.
Okay. Well, since I'm the one that didn't see it today, I can talk about it. I remember seeing this movie like 4 or 5 years ago. I think I saw it on like HBO or something at the time. I remember Timberlake was okay as the lead. This is like one of his first real lead opportunities. And he was okay, but not super dynamic or charming. So here's the synopsis for In Time. It's 2169, and people are genetically engineered with perfect health and appearance. Each person has a digital clock on their forearm, and when they turn 25, they stop aging, and their clock begins counting down from 1 year. So if they didn't do anything, once you turn 25, you're going to die at 26 if you do nothing to earn time. Time has become the universal currency, and it can be transferred between people, or you can get a thing called a time capsule, which you can add to your time. It's like a time bank kind of thing. The film focuses on two different places, basically. Dayton is a poor manufacturing area where people generally live on 24 hours or less, basically live day-to-day, paycheck type thing. And you have New Greenwich, which is the wealthy people, where they have enough time on their clock to live for centuries, or essentially they're immortal. Justin plays Will Salas. He's a 28-year-old factory worker. He lives with his 50-year-old mother, but everybody looks like they're 25. And he basically, some series of events happens, and his mom dies, where he just couldn't quite save her. And then basically the plot goes back and forth where he gets time and he has time. He's accused of murder, trying to clear his name. He interacts with these rich people and goes from there. I'll let you tell you what everybody, what you saw. I've got a bunch of questions that have to do with the reality of the world, which could or could not apply, but we're going to do it because that's our perspective on things. So I'm going to let you talk about what you thought of what you saw, Daniel.
Okay, well, I'm going to bring up a couple of clips that talk about the economics of this, because they're, like you were saying, they're essentially using time as a currency. And my take on it is that, this is a confused neoclassical Marxian viewpoint on wealth and, where it comes from and exploitation and all the rest of it. It's we talked about The Matrix, and you had that story saying that it was influenced by communists. This movie, In Time, seems to be very much influenced by communist thought. So here's a clip where the rich guy who Will saves from being mugged explains how the rich are hoarding the currency and keeping it away from the masses. So here we go.
How old are you in real time?
28.
I'm 105. Does it show? But the day comes when you've had enough. Your mind can be spent even if your body's not.
That's your problem? You've been alive too long. You ever known anyone who's died?
For a few to be immortal, many must die.
What the hell's that supposed to mean?
You really don't know, do you? Everyone can't live forever. Where would we put them? Why do you think there are time zones? Why do you think taxes and prices go up the same day in the ghetto? The cost of living keeps rising to make sure people keep dying. How else could there be men with 1 million years while most live day to day? But the truth is, there's more than enough. No one has to die before their time. If you had as much time as I have, what would you do with it?
If I had all that time, I sure as hell wouldn't waste it.
So yeah, some pretty Marxist Malthusian bullshit there.
Yeah, so that was like a little bit quiet. I couldn't quite hear it, but I heard a couple points.
Okay, well, I'll bump it up in the playback where I'll plug it in directly. So we'll just pretend that we heard it.
All right, give your take on what was just said.
All right. So that was just a snippet about the Henry Hamilton guy, I think that's his name, the rich guy who Will saves, explaining that for the many for the few to have so much time, the many can't live very long. It's a very Malthusian argument. He said, you know, where would we put them all? And it definitely brings up the Marxist class warfare, and the wage gap or the inequality becomes a big deal in this movie based on that clip. They talk about the cost of living rising along with the taxes on the same day, and that's to ensure that more people die. And somehow the rich are in control of the cost of these goods.
So the rich are like a predator class?
Yeah, yeah. There's actually another clip that I can play in a little bit where he calls it dog-eat-dog capitalism or the law of the jungle, something like that. I'll play that in a bit, too. It's terrible.
Yeah, it seems to be like this zero-sum game where there are winners and losers and there's not enough to go around. Or is it... It frustrates me because they're just setting up this bullshit scenario. You know, from a movie-making, storytelling standpoint, fine. You want to come up with some story and you want it to not really make sense, fine, you can do that. But it seems to be that they're coming up with some bullshit scenario that would never happen and then using it to make a statement about the real world, which is really bad. Like, look at this bullshit scenario that would never happen. See how capitalism is bad? Okay. You're really going to make it a straw man.
Yeah, no, it is a work of fiction, of course, so it's not necessarily intended to be a statement on the world of today, but it's hard to not read it as such, you know?
Yeah, it's clearly not overtly saying that, but we've heard these arguments before from Malthus and Marx, so it's hard not to attribute that to this film, as if they are trying to make a statement of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Keep going. What else you got?
Well, they're certainly playing up the exploitation angle, and that the rich are in control, I assume, of the government of whatever society this is, because they can control the costs of things, and they can basically manipulate the behaviors of the masses so that more of them will die at a given time because they're running out of space, you know, that Malthus argument.
Right. Where would we put all the people that would just keep living? We'll just run out of space, and we'll run out of resources. Now, the movie doesn't... Does the movie explain where this time, how the time currency is generated? Or is there just a finite amount that gets spread around among people?
Well, as you were alluding to earlier, I did watch the first half of the film again today, and not the second half of it, but I do recall that the babies are born with these things kind of embedded in them or built in them somehow. And the timer doesn't start counting down until they reach the age of 25.
Right.
And it's sort of like a trust account. So like even the parents don't have access to the currency, these hours and minutes and days, until the kid is 25. And then once they're 25, they can trade with it. They can give it away. They can earn more. They can do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if I recall at the end of the film, it's basically the guy from Mad Men, the Pete whatever guy, Vincent Krauthauser, I think is his name, or Krauthauser. Yeah, that guy. So he's like the main villain in this. And he is the rich, you know, billionaire with a million years of time, and he's hoarding it in these vaults. And Will breaks into the vaults and starts giving away the currency to people, and they, you know, all of a sudden, this flush of currency, this flush of money reaches the people, and they just raise the prices in accordance to maintain the same level of poverty. And I guess he's hoarding some kind of generation method of this currency of the time, and Will goes in to try to smash it. And I think that's how it ends. I'm not really doing it justice because I didn't watch the whole thing recently, just half of it.
Yeah.
But they're saying he's hoarding it, and therefore he's bad, and that, you know, of course, it's not a coherent argument, but you hear it from Keynesians all the time, like, oh, it's these rich people not spending their money that is preventing the economy from growing as quickly as it should, or whatever. So we need to have like higher taxes or higher whatever to force them to change their behaviors and spend that money.
Negative interest rates, that sort of thing.
Yeah, get it into circulation or whatever.
Right.
But we've had this talk before, and we've taken the Walter Block defending the undefendable arguments, where I think he has an article about the hoarder and how the hoarder is actually helping people because the funds that he's hoarding are not competing for goods and services along with you and me. Therefore, he's helping to reduce the demand for something and thus lower the prices. So, you know,
right,
by having those funds not actively chasing goods, it's beneficial. And those funds are available for, you know, whoever has them, the rich person, to invest them in some productive asset, into capital goods, which improves the living standards of everybody. You know, there's this big push to say that automation and robotics are going to drive out the common worker and destroy low-wage jobs. And it's just the opposite. It's government policy that's destroying the low-wage jobs and inciting or incentivizing companies to invest in robotics because it becomes more cost-benefit, you know, more beneficial for them to just maybe prematurely in a free market, but because the costs have been skewed, they're going to save money by having a robotic taco maker or a robotic burger maker or whatever, where you can go there instead of talking to someone in a, you know, visor hat with a little logo on it and a headset.
Yeah, you got the minimum wage, and you're going to incentivize the burger maker to look at robots as a better alternative rapidly than paying somebody, you know, $15 an hour to flip burgers, where the robot, you know, never asks for a wage increase, doesn't have a benefits package desire, any of that stuff. So, when government gets involved and artificially incentivizes these things, it does rapidly speed the increase of mechanization. And people complain about, you know, not having a person to talk to, not having a person to complain to or whatever. Yeah, it's government is immune from the blame, though. It's always the business owner that is trying to cope with increasing regulations to try and continue to make a dollar, to try and continue to provide a service, to provide for his family and what have you. And they get the blame. It's a no-win situation.
Yeah, it's certainly unfortunate that that's how these things get portrayed in news media and things of that nature, because it truly is a result of the government policies that create difficulties in having hired labor. So, you know, alternatives are going to be sought. And there's no fear. There's no need to fear mechanization or robotics. All it means is that you know, human capital and human labor is freed up to pursue other interests and other needs. Like, we're never going to fully satisfy all the needs of all the billions of people on the planet. And anytime we increase the efficiency of the tools and the capital equipment that are available to people to use, it doesn't mean that you know, horse and buggy manufacturers are now you know, not going to do anything. They're just going to all die. It means they're going to do other things. You know, the automobile industry hired many more people than the horse and buggy industry ever did, and it's a constantly evolving thing. And anytime you increase the efficiency and the power of what can be accomplished by the human labor, you know, it benefits everybody. There's a Robert Wenzel article where he talks about, you know, no need to fear the robotic revolution, and I'll post that down below. And, you know, he makes a very good argument, and I think he's correct in it. He's a pretty good Austrian. There's no need to fear robotics. It's going to increase the living standards of everybody.
Yeah, because human desire is infinite, and there will always be some desire for the market to fulfill. So usually when people whine about mechanization or what have you, it's people in like an entrenched monopoly job or some sort of a job where they're seeking protection against innovation. So, and they always whine to government to prevent this new innovation from happening. We see it in the taxi industry. I don't know if it happened in the horse and buggy industry, but it probably did. Gladly that it didn't.
They weren't successful.
Right.
But imagine if the amount of regulation that exists today were around then, we would probably still have horse and buggy as a major thing, you know? Like, it would just stifle innovation and technological advancement and growth in living standards.
Yeah, and government is not seen as a stifler of innovation. If anything, it's praised as a funder of scientific research and all this crap. And, like, you know, providing incentives and benefits to people who adopt, you know, solar energy or who are looking to develop that sort of thing or any kind of alternative energies or whatever the cause du jour is. It's seen as a where, you know, the market is failing, government steps in to make it happen. And it's really doesn't get the blame for all the innovation that's stifled, all the innovation that is prevented. And it's the unseen cost. We don't know. We don't know where we would be without it, what kind of advances we would have. All we know that if the market is really powerful, you know, human desire is really strong, and government is this massive, heavy yoke around our neck, but we still get a lot of things done. But it's not seen as the villain that it should be.
Yeah, well said. Well, yeah, I think there's another clip I can play here, and then we can start to wrap up on this movie. It's not a great movie. I liked it better the first time I saw it. The second time where I've watched the first half again, it's getting pretty hard to watch. So here's the second clip.
I don't believe we've had the pleasure of your company before, Mr.
Salas. Will Salas.
Philippe Weiss. You must come from time.
You could say I'm gambling my inheritance.
You must be young. When you've been 25 for 85 years like I have, and knowing only a random act of violence can take your life, you learn to appreciate what you have. Of course, some think what we have is unfair. The time difference between zones.
I've heard that.
But Hasn't evolution always been unfair? Always been survival of the fittest? This is merely Darwinian capitalism. Natural selection.
Absolutely. The strong survive.
So terrible. Were you able to hear that?
I heard it. Perhaps you could set up exactly where that was in the movie and what the characters and what they were. What was happening? Was that the poker game?
Yeah, that's the initial meeting of Philippe Weiss, the Vincent guy, where he's playing the poker game and he's talking about how he must come for money and he's there gambling and they have this discussion about Darwinian capitalism and only the strong survive and how it may seem unfair,
right.
But you know it's totally justified because you know the rich get to live off the oppression of the weak or whatever.
Right. So capitalism is predatory. Right.
Seems to be the story here. Yeah.
Yes. So I guess we could mention briefly. We've talked about this in the past, but this old idea that capitalism is a zero sum game where there's only a finite amount and there's winners and losers, where in reality it raises all boats. Just because there's a massive gap between the richest and the poorest doesn't mean that the poorest are worse off than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever. It brings benefit to all. You could say this better than I can, Daniel. It provides products for cheaper and cheaper, and increasingly new miracle-type products for cheaper and cheaper, so the point where even the poorest among us can afford like an iPhone or air conditioning or a refrigerator or a microwave or whatever.
Right, yeah.
And the kings of old couldn't dream of any of these wonders. So the comparative living standard is really what should be the metric, not your percentage of income versus somebody else's income.
That's just huge. Jealousy. That's
right. And jealousy is triumphed in the media, where it's all about how the people in the 99% deserve the money of others. Using government. Government is always the great redistributor. So it's seen as the wonderful actor of stealing from one person and giving to another person, and how noble and virtuous that is. But what
indeed.
Is the story is the living standard metric, and that's what needs to be looked at, not the wealth gap. The wealth gap is real, of course. There are people who earn a lot.
Yeah, I agree. And you were saying a minute ago that, you know, maybe I could say it better. And I think Murray actually says it best. So I'll throw in a clip of Murray right here that explains a little bit more on this from an economics angle.
Paul Craig Roberts, before he became a supply sider, wrote two very good books on this, Alienation and Marxism and something else. He describes key to alienation being eradication and division of labor. That's the key to Marxist, one of Marx's goals. And what happens is when communists took over in Russia, as Roberts points out, they try to establish war communism, eliminate money and so forth and so on, so-called war communism. They try to establish it. It didn't work. And Lenin, being a supreme pragmatist, step back follows, and then reestablish capitalism during the 1920s. Well, I'll say one thing about the theory of value here before I leave Marx. If you read Das Kapital, first volume, there's all the contradictions between first and third volume and all that. Just read the first volume. First three pages will tell you all. He starts off by saying products exchange at certain prices. Okay? What determines these prices? What determines these values? And he says, well, what is it? First of all, he says values are equal. Okay? The first mistake. Since the price of something is equal to something else, since the Wonder Bread costs $1.09 a loaf, this means that somehow the loaf and the bread are an equal value. And the bread and the money are equal value, or something else is $1.09 a loaf, that's $1.09, that's equal value. So he immediately says there's an equality of value. So that's the first mistake, since as we know, Austrian subjectivism is the fact that there's any exchange at all means there must be an inequality of values. Both parties value the product unequally. In other words, if I buy a newspaper for a quarter, it's not that I value the quarter equally with the newspaper, or a newsstand deal doesn't value me equally. Otherwise, why bother exchanging at all? What's the point of exchanging if it's both the same thing anyway? So the point is that both have a reverse inequality. I value the newspaper, getting the Washington Post or whatever, higher than I do my quarter. And the newsstand deal, of course, values the quarter higher than keeping the Washington Post. And we have a double reverse inequality of values. This creates the condition for exchange, for profitable exchange for both parties, or both parties benefit. So there's no equality of value, quite the opposite. There's a double inequality. It's the first problem in Marx's formulation. Then he says, well, they have equality of value between these two things which are the same price. So what is equal about them? What is there in these things which are equal? Not of equal weight, that can't be it. Not of equal volume, that can't be it. He finally works the thing, it must be equal quantity of labor after a certain exegesis. And at that point, you really don't have to read the rest of it because you have about four or five fallacies all piled on top of each other. And then, of course, there's a problem. How do you get, how do you arrive at different prices that have same quantity of labor and all the rest of it? There's a whole bunch of problems with labor theory of value, which I need not go into. Von Bauwerk had a famous refutation of Marx's theory of value and theory of prices, which is available in edition, separate edition. It's called Karl Marx and the Close of a System. Unfortunately, what happens is always when Marx is refuted, the Marxists have a fallback position. So it's very much like a religious cult. You have a fallback. If Marx makes a whole bunch of predictions or a whole bunch of statements which turn out to be wrong, he then changes the terms of the argument. You say, well, he didn't really mean that. And so Marx obviously meant to explain the price system by the labor theory of value. But it turns out he couldn't explain it. The Marxists say, well, he didn't really mean prices. He just meant value in some mystical inherent sense. It had nothing to do with prices. So that's one way of wash that out. So you can't really refute it at all. A second thing, Marx's famous prediction of why it is we'll have inevitable proletarian revolution, that the workers get worse and worse off, the impoverishment of the working class, and they finally rise up in desperation. So it's obvious through history, in the 19th century and 20th century preceded, the workers are getting better and better off. So it doesn't just refute Marx's key prediction about why proletarian revolution is inevitable. So the Marxist fallback position, what he didn't mean absolute impoverishment, he meant relative impoverishment. He meant that the workers, even though they might be much better off than they were 50 years ago, are still less well off than Rockefeller or Bunker Hunt. So, you change the terms. I can't see anybody really engaging in bloody revolution, committing their life to bloody revolution because you only have one swimming pool instead of five. Somehow that's the so-called relative deprivation. This is, by the way, the gimmick by which everybody's always... You always have a huge number of people under the poverty line. You keep redefining the poverty line. So poverty doesn't mean subsistence. It means whatever. TV sets. If you don't have a TV set, they're not called impoverished, under the poverty line. And so you keep pushing the so-called poverty line up, so you always have at least a third of the population impoverished. You can never eliminate poverty because there's always some guy with five yachts instead of one.
Well said, Mr. Rothbard. He's great, isn't he?
He's the best. And this is maybe a good time to throw in the discussion of, would you rather have a world where there are a tremendous number of teachers and firefighters that are able to competently teach and fight fires, and a relatively small number of people that are super desirable for our entertainment purposes, or would you rather be the other way around, where there's a really tiny number of teachers that are hugely paid and a really tiny number of firefighters that are hugely paid, and then a massive number of people that can entertain us. So the teachers would be massively paid, and the entertainers would be tinily paid. I think most people would say, well, I'd rather have a house that's not on fire. I'd rather have a well-educated person that is, maybe not so greatly entertained or what have you, than as opposed to someone who is massively entertained, but then their house is on fire.
Yeah, so there's that Don Bordeaux article posted on Wenzel's site where he's talking about what this inequality means and whether you'd prefer to have a bunch of teachers or firefighters and all of that. And why
teachers are paid so poorly and firefighters are paid so poorly compared to entertainers who are paid so massively.
Right, and it's because the funds are tied to what revenue they create, But my response would be, let the free market decide. Like, if the free market decides that there should be a handful of really well-paid teachers that teach millions of people, fine, great. If there's a Michael Jordan of teaching, awesome. They deserve to make millions of dollars. And the one sort of issue I have with this article is that the examples given are two government-protected monopolies.
Yeah.
Need the government to enforce the payment for the services and also the usage of those services. Like, you can't choose for a different fire service. You can't choose within limits. You can sort of choose like different schooling methods, but you're still paying for the one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my one argument with that article. Cause he doesn't take the original questioner to task about, well, those are, government monopolies and whatever pricing they do have is artificially supported compared to what it presumably would be in a free market.
Right. But his point is valid in that there are a great number of, say, cashiers at a supermarket. How many cashiers are there in the world, and how are they paid? Well, would you rather have a competent cashier? Should there just be one cashier that's super good at his job and there's a line a mile long? Or would you be better off served with a dozen cashiers in the supermarket that are all, you know, equally competent and can do their job just fine?
Right. And my response to that would be robots.
Robots.
Self-checkout, baby.
Self-checkout. You know, there are a lot of people that hate self-checkout. They're like, I go to a store. They need to do that for me. I can't believe I got to do this for myself. What's the point? I'm paying for them to do it for me. No. But whatever.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, they're right. But also, in a sense, you can choose to go to a different store that has more checkers or whatever. You know, like part of the product you're buying isn't just the tub of ice cream. It could be the exact same tub of ice cream as somewhere else, but it's the environment in which you're purchasing it. Like, you're buying that entire process, you know?
Yeah, you're buying the entire experience. So, yeah, maybe there is some supermarket that has zero checkers. Maybe you prefer that. Maybe you prefer to get a slightly better price and then do the self-checkout. Or maybe there's a place that is fully servicing to your desires and does everything for you. You'll pay a little bit more for that service. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, indeed, sir.
Servicing a market desire. I'm all for it, baby.
Well, hey, man, I hate to cut this one short. We're talking about In Time, and I'm out of time. My family got home, and I got to go help with the kids. So, you know, this wasn't that great of a movie. So I think we've probably beat it up enough. We threw Murray at it a little bit, and I don't think that there's a whole bunch left standing after all that.
Yeah, it's a Malthusian, Marxian metaphor type, analogy type movie that's making up some just bullshit scenario and then saying, look at how terrible capitalism is, when it has nothing to do with any of that, and how great Marxian redistribution is and how everybody should have the same and everything. And it's just real dumb.
Real dumb indeed. Yep, kind of a crap fest. Anyway, let's wrap it up here. We've been the Reed Rothbard Podcast. We've got books, articles, lectures, this podcast, a bunch of stuff for sale. So if you want to support us, buy some of our t-shirts or hoodies, sign up for the readit4.me website. And yeah, you want to sign us out there, Mr. Robert?
What he said. Thanks everybody for listening. What do you want to do next week, Daniel?
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Okay. We'll figure something out. Who knows? Take care, everybody. See you next time.
Peace out, homies.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.